Thank you, Brother Price, and everybody said praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Please take your seats. Thank you very much. I respect very greatly the clear, strong challenge and message that Brother Tenney gave last night. Like a good hunting dog, I want to honor that point this morning. He had the mind of God. I love him for preaching revival. He believes it. It's not just a hot-selling popular item to Brother Tenney. He wants revival. I do too. Now, I'm not going to deal with revival this morning directly, but it has a very definite undertone which will prepare us for the rest of my work for this week, which will be revival. I have something this morning for pastors. I have something for pastors' wives. I have something here this morning for earnest saints. I have something here this morning for mothers of small children. I have something here for mothers struggling with the difficulties of adolescent and teenage children. I have a challenge for all of you. My subject today is the use of and the replenishment of virtue. The use of and the replenishment of virtue. That's such a sweet text to read to you in Mark chapter 5. And I'm going to begin at verse 25. It's about a precious little woman and our blessed Lord. The use of virtue and the replenishment of virtue. Now you have it open in your laps. Let me talk a little bit before we read the text. I have certain basic premises that I'm going to build all I have to offer you on. If you don't buy what my premises are, you won't buy my conclusions. So listen and see if you want to go with me. I believe that every person has X number of units of life to give, no more. I believe that weariness, wornness, exhaustion comes to all of us. Whether we are wasting our units of life or whether we're wisely investing them, we give out what we have and then we haven't anymore. But I believe that the units of life are replenishable. I believe that virtue can be put back in that vessel to be used again and again and again. And we need each other. God knows we need each other and what every joint supplies to the body. Jesus said, "Come unto me, all you that labor heavy laden, I'll give you rest." He's saying, you who have worked, you who put out, you have spent your units, come here. I'll give you rest for it. I'll replenish your forces, your powers, your gifts, your abilities, your talents, your endowments, your investable forces. Come here, he's saying. Take my yoke upon you. Learn of me. My yoke is easy. My burden is light. And the result is you shall find, discover, experience rest. Not to your skin and your flesh, but to your soul. The deepest portion of your productive being. Come unto me, ye that labor, heavy laden, I'll give you rest. The difference between our humanity and divinity is that divinity is never weary. The Almighty is never weary. But we are told that the young men shall faint. But that the operation of the Holy Spirit in our life is that they'll be enabled to produce, to work, to give out units and get it back, because it says they shall mount up with wings as an eagle. These who are weary, these who have spent, these who have given, these who have put out, these who have offered themselves, they shall mount up. That's great. It's good to be able just to get up out of bed, but there is an experience where we can mount up with wings as eagles. That's the ultimate of mounting up. And I'm going to talk to you about the use of and the replenishment of virtue in the reading of the text, beginning at verse 25. How beautiful is this story? And a certain woman which had an issue of blood, a serious illness. A certain woman who bled continuously. A certain woman which had an issue of blood 12 years. Hey, that's a long time. That's as long as a dog usually lives and well cared for. That's usually a lifetime of a family milk cow. 12 years. That's as long as a child goes to school from grade 1 to graduation. That's a long time to be bleeding, to be hurting, to be hopeless, to not find any recovery. It's a long, long time. Costly illness. And had suffered many things of many physicians. You can say that in 1985. And had spent, you can say that in 1985, and had spent all that she had, and was nothing bettered, but rather grew worse. Now that's quite a test for a doctor, wouldn't you say? If anybody could help that girl, it could help most anybody. She was really sick. It was not psychosomatic. She was terribly afflicted in her body. It didn't have to do with psychology. It had to do with blood and pain and cost and hopelessness. Repeated failed efforts. When she had heard of Jesus, came in the press behind and touched his garment. For she said, if I may touch but his clothes, I shall be whole. What a beautiful word. Whole. W-H-O-L-E. Whole. And straightway the fountain of her blood was dried up. Straightway, which is an ancient word for immediate. Not delayed at all. Isn't that nice? Straightway, the fountain of her blood was dried up. Goody, goody, goody. And she felt in her body that she was healed of that plague. Isn't that good? Isn't that wonderful? I like to meet that girl when I get there. I want to see the glow on her face of her resurrected body. I want to hear that for myself. I know all about it, but I want to hear the story again. Like the babies and the grandchildren. Big Daddy, tell me one more story. And if you tell it one word wrong, I want to hear her tell it just like it is. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself, did you get the relation between the verses? She knew in her body she had got something. He knew in his self he had given something. There was a transmission. There's a transaction. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that virtue was gone out of him. We're looking at an expenditure. We're looking at a debt. We're looking at big checks that got thrown out. We're looking in your purse and pulling out a big one. It's gone. I had one, and it's gone. He sensed that. It was discernible. It testified to him that Jesus knew in himself. Are you looking at the verse there? Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that virtue had gone out of him, turned him about in the press and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said unto him, "Thou seest the multitude thronging thee, and sayest thou, who touched me?" And he looked round about to see her that had done this thing. And the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what was done in her, she didn't avoid him or neglect him, she came and fell down before him and told him all the truth. The use of and the replenishment of virtue. Now, I don't have anything to work with here today for any kind of visual. I barely got here, much less bring anything. I'll tell this for the fun of the preachers. I had carefully selected what I thought was the nice stuff out of my pastoral Bible. I said, well, I might be able to use a little less, maybe. And the stuff that was cornbread and oil patch and home stuff, I put it in another stack. And my family was lined up down the hall. One had my suitcase, one had my clothes, and one had my Bible. And I ran through, "There goes Dad! See you later, Dad!" And I picked up the wrong stack of stuff. So if this here goes wrong, you'll know what I did. I got the wrong outline. I have another little funny I'll tell you. I have a lovely daughter, 15 now, but when she was 3, she answered the phone at our house because she was as quick as a little deer. Couldn't nobody reach that phone quick as she could. So one time I had my son in agricultural business, and he radioed in on the company radio that he had broken a tool, broken machine. I said, "Well, I'll be right out there, pal." So I went out there, and dumb like I was, I reached down, and there was a piece of half-inch iron that I pulled up, and when I did, it was the wrong thing to have done. It just, I thought I'd kill myself. And I was in such terror of pain that I couldn't see straight, but I did struggle back to the pickup and got back to the house, and when I was there, son, I was ready for anybody, anywhere to help me. And I had always heard about chiropractors, but at that point in my life, I thought they were just... But a guy at the barbershop last week that I had a lot of confidence that he was at least sensible told me what one under the bridge at Westlake had done for him. And so I said, "Hey, get my clothes back on me and take me over there to the chiropractor." And so, oh man, you ought to see my face. Mark of pain, stress. And the telephone rang in a small Louisiana town. And it got on real quick. Our pastor heard. So the telephone rang, and Lori's hand picked it up and wanted to say, "Oh, is our pastor hurt?" And she said, "Yes, ma'am, he is hurt." "Well, where is he now?" He said, "Well, Mama took him to the psychiatrist." And so the nurse that was the nanny that was in our home at the time, she said, "Oh dear, not the psychiatrist. Let's don't tell him that." And she said, "Well, what was it?" She said, "It's the chiropractor." She said, "What that is?" And he said, "Well, you know, they rub on you and help your back." Telephone rang. "Hello? Oh, has our pastor been hurt?" "Yes." "Well, where is he now?" "Well, Mama took him to that man that rubbed her back." It just got worse and worse. So, if you don't like what I have to say, you can just be merciful to me and remember that I've been to the psychiatrist. Okay? For treatment. Here's my idea that I'm going to work this earnestly. And with whatever powers I have to persuade you, I want very much to change every listener in this class. Now, as I look across this audience, I do know a few people. And many of those that I know are prime examples of doing what I want to teach we all should do. They do it regularly, they do it faithfully, they do it artfully, skillfully. But I still want to, quote,
preach to you, unquote. Because if I could increase that beauty in your life just 3%, it would be revolutionary. It is so good to put back what was given you. It is so wonderful to replenish the virtue in others. We need it. Okay, I'm going to go on a pretty long trip here now, so I'd like you to hang in there with me. What happened here was a woman in an incalculable death need. Oh, I'm glad that's not my wife in that condition. I'm glad that's not my sister's or my daughter. She was so sick. Her prospectus was so hopeless. She had a great need. But she touched Jesus. And when she touched him, she had an immediate personal, inward, convincing knowledge, a comprehensive collection of knowledge that she was okay. Oh, boy. How I'd love to have been a photographer and caught that look in her eyes, her face, that she knew that that's over with. I won't ever be sick again. I'll sleep and I'll mop and I'll have home life and Daddy and I will have our home and our marriage and our children will not have to wait on me no more. I'm well. Ooh, I'm well. I'm well as I was when I was a girl. I'm wonderful. Boy, that'd have been nice. But I also know that a similar experience in a negative pole happened within our sweet Jesus. He said, I know too. I feel it. That something went out. She said, I felt it, that something came in. There was a transfer of virtue. Now that's such an intimate thing about our Lord that I'm a bit reticent to even speak on it because it's so intimate what he revealed about himself. It's almost as if if I saw him changing shirts, I would want to look away the other way. I wouldn't want to see his naked body. He's so blessed and so holy. But he wrote it down here, and I'm called to teach it. So I will reverence our process with my head over my heart. Something very intimate about Jesus, that he said, virtue has gone out of me. It seems as almost as if he was talking to himself. It doesn't seem like anybody there would understand what he was really saying. Big chunk went out. A whole slice of my pie is gone. A whole bale of hay left just then. One of the big bales got spent just then. I'm not all that I was before. I don't have what I had before. I shared. I spent. It's gone. Virtue went out of me. And he could tell it. And it was a phenomenon to him. He physically reacted to it, mentally, psychologically. He just made a remark. He said, I need to find out now who did that. Who touched me? He asked that information. He said, there's no way. He said, such a press, crowd, nobody could tell. But he said, yes, I need to know. He needed to get something back for that. Now, he was deeply disappointed, and he actually griped about it. After one momentous healing in which there were 10 lepers, can you handle that? 10 lepers immediately, instantly, gloriously, fully restored to correct human function. They were healed. And he said, go down and show yourselves to the priest. And 10 walked away, and in a moment, one came back and fell down and put that virtue back. And he appreciated that. He received it. He accepted it. We're taught that that's the thing to do is to come back and to put that unit back in there. The scriptures give us this concept. To whom much is given. If you have received many units from somewhere, then you are under a sacred duty. Much is required of you to put it back. And someone spoke last night of what a fortunate, blessed people we are. Oh, God. We don't know how fortunate, how blessed, and how advantaged we are. We can't tell it. Unless you're a traveler, unless you are a viewer of the hostilities of the world, the wars of the world, the diseases of the world, the crippling sufferings of thousands and millions of people, and the hunger in Africa, the civil unrest in Central America, the oppression in Eastern Europe. Unless you and I are there, we just don't know how really abundantly fortunate we are. And so we don't use our duty to say thanks. I want to turn with you to 1 Samuel 18, 6 and 7 and show you what happened in among the ancients. People have not just got smart lately. Did you know that? People's been smart a long, long time. Don't forget that. Adam knew every animal by name and called it. And he's the first zookeeper we had. I don't know all of them. I just say that's some kind of a monkey. And that looks like a zebra. Guess that's what that is. But Adam, our father, knew all of it without asking anybody. And Solomon knew the name of every tree. People have been smart a long time. And these common laity, the grassroots of the human family, have been smart a long time. And I want to examine one of the brilliant moments in the history of Israel with you in 1 Samuel 18 and 6. It delights me that I know I'm speaking here largely to Bible students. I won't have to tell this story because you've already got all of it in your mind at the moment. I'll just hit the salient points and save your time. 1 Samuel 18, 6, and it came to pass as they came, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistines, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Now, I'm going to have to take the weight of habitual traditional preaching out of your mind a moment to show you what I see in this. Let's not think for a moment about the jealousy of Saul. Just don't think about that. Let's think of what you are looking at here. David had spent an enormous chunk of his virtue. He jeopardized, as the apostles did, he jeopardized his very life. All he had to bet, he bet on one horse. Everything. He put his life in his hand. He went out and using the ultimate of his courage and his faith and his belief and his trust and his confidence, he went out and met Goliath. He used all of his know-how, all of his training, all of his expertise, all of his skill, all of his accuracy, all of his earnestness, all of his concentration. He just poured gift after gift after gift after gift into this moment when he released that stone. And it knocked Goliath down, probably unconscious. He followed up on it and continues to pour out this virtue. He continues to pour out this gift. And he runs this lad of a boy. Mr. Stoneman, don't let me get real loud. I'd rather folks try to hear me than wish I'd go away. He runs and stands up on the body of the giant and takes his sword and completes the work he began. He decapitates him. And that's all I want to tell about that. You know, when you're speaking to people who really know the Bible, you have to not belabor the point, so I'm trying to, you know the rest of it, I don't have to say, okay? What I want to point out is that he had gorgeously, gloriously, generously, fully, with great casting out of himself, he put everything on the line. He gave of himself. Ardently, fervently, with all the power of his youth, ardor and strength and heat. He did a thing. He did his thing. He did a number on it. Now, these ancient people had smarts. They said we might need that again. But the Philistines, they don't hardly ever go away. And they didn't. All the days of Saul, they had sore war with them. They said there may come a day again when we need somebody with that kind of fortitude, that kind of impossible faith, that kind of uncanny accuracy. Somebody with an arm on him like this. We might need one of these giant killers again. So, by the built-in virtue of good people, they said, we need to cheer him up a little bit. He spent about all he had, the kid did. Let's put it back. Hello? The use of the replenishment virtue. So, the Bible said the women from all the cities. It was not just a spasmodic accident that this happened. It had to be communication involved. It had to be a plan. It had to be a leader. It had to be a purpose. There was purpose in this madness. They said, hurry, get your tambourine. Bring your guitar. Bring your fiddle. Bring the bass fiddle if you got a place. Come on, let's get together. Hey, there's somebody out there. Fill his guts out. Let's go put his guts back in for it. Pardon the coarseness, but if you're not ridiculous, you won't be remembered. Here it was. He had spent. And the ancient knowledge of these old people of another day, they were so smart, they said, let's get it back in. And so they said, we need a few instruments to do it. And the Bible said they came out to meet King Saul. It appears to have been a customary thing. A repeated action, not just an isolated incident. They probably always did that after the battle. When Daddy came back, when Uncle George came back, when Brother came back, they didn't just stay around the house drinking tea and fan themselves until they got home, and when they walked in the door and said, well, I didn't think you'd ever get back. They didn't meet their warriors in that fashion. They went outside the gates of the city and down the streets and the caminos and the roads and the ways. And they went out to meet them and they went out there to sing and they had a program prepared. And the message of their song was, Saul has killed himself. I don't know how many times they had sung that song. Don't know who wrote it. Don't know how many times it had been repeated, but they knew it needed to be repeated. That every time their king went out and expended his units of energy, that somebody needs to put it back. And so when the warriors came home, the women knew what to do. It was put on their pretty things. It was put on their nicest shoes. It was to comb their hair, to dress their faces. It was to gather the music instruments and go out and sing to them. And not only that, but dance. They were saying to their men, look, we love you this time. It was not it was not wanting to stay longer. It was not honey, tear the garbage out. It was to go out and to meet them with fervor and force, with breath and volition and power. It was to go out and to say, I love you. I rejoice that you're here. I'm so glad I'm a dancer about it. What would have to happen to you in the secular life today? A new Cadillac Eldorado? Give me one and I'll dance upside down on that roof. I'd like one so well. But there are some people that you can do great things to and they won't bat an eye. The man giving away corn, you know, to the laziest man in the world. The winner said, shell it and put it in my pocket. Now that's what I'm working on. I'm talking about the use of virtue is common, but it is expensive. I've been on this earth long enough to know that nickels had value, dimes were wealth. We'd go to the little stores and stand by the candy counter. This is our money. We raked the yard. We cut the grass or we caught the horse or whatever we did to get that money. It was ours. Put it in our hand. We were free to do with it whatever we wanted as long as it was decent. And I can remember standing at that old colored man's store and he had a candy counter, and there was coconut candy, chocolate candy, peanut candy, other beautiful things. It was just one of those things that had meaning to me as a baby. I remembered that with my one or two nickels, I could make a choice. And I wanted to make the choice that would bring me the most pleasure for the use of my nickel. I'm still a little child, and I'm still looking in the counter of life. And it means more to me this day how I spend my nickel than it did when I was 20 and 30 and 40. I don't have very many left. I've lived over 70% of what the expected American male life expectancy is. I mean, I'm 7 down, 3 to go. Percentage-wise. If you're 35, you're 5 down and 5 to go. These guys, 35, thinking themselves are so young. You're half dead. Now, if you laugh another time, I'm going to write your name down on the board. The older you get, the less of these nickels you've got. And the more serious you are about what you buy with your sacred units of life. Now, everybody varies in their degree of aliveness. Some are this alive, some are that alive, some are that alive. I can't reach far enough to say how alive Brother Tenney is. I'd need fishing poles on each hand. He is alive. I saw him give chunks here last night. I saw him do what Elkanah did to sweet little Hannah when she was so grieved and when she needed a gift. At the feast, he brought her a whole shoulder of lamb. The other people got a piece, got a pork chop. She got a whole ham, a whole shoulder. And that's what Brother Tenney was doing here last night. And while I admired him and while I loved him, in my heart I said, oh God, see that he gets it back somewhere. Because we're going to need that in 1986 and 1987 and 1988. Hey, you know, there ain't no free lunch. Only God can give without needing to be replenished. And God manifested in the flesh needed to be replenished. So I'm sure that you do and others do. Now I'm going to knock the far out of a folly and a fallacy in American jargon. He'll get the big head. Well, do you want to be a pinhead? There is so little danger in reality of a person who is a performer, who is a producer, who is a giver, who is a lover, who is a caring soul, who is a shepherd, who gives his life. There's so little danger of his getting the big head. It won't stay there long enough to get the big head. He'll have it given again. And so in this place, in the text, Jesus gave handsomely. And the little woman didn't run off and in reticence and shyness say, well, I don't want to talk to him, the strange man. She came and told him all about it. She told him how many doctors she'd gone to. She told how her husband had striven and worked with the sweat of his brow and the pain of his back and made money. He said, here, Francis, here's a little more money. Go to another doctor. See if we can't have help. See if you can't be my beautiful bride again. And she'd take that money and spend it. He'd go back to the fields and come in cramped and sweaty. Here's a day's wages. Go again, mother. And she'd go again. Somebody handily take that cash and hurt her farther. And she'd come home and he'd say, oh, you're better this time, aren't you, dear? And she'd say, I wish that I used the fruit of your hard labor. I wish I could tell you I'm better, but oh, I feel so bad. And that was the case day after day after day till she met Jesus. But Jesus was one. stopped that whole hole. He stopped the whole leak with one water.
But understand, he did not do that effortlessly and without cost. He made the remark, the strongest of all young men, full of ardor and zeal and power. He complained, he admitted it.
Oh, I am less than I was. I felt virtue go out of me. I need to discover where that went to. And she paid it back. She acknowledged it. She told him all about it. She told him the story. She expanded the details. She expressed her joy, her pleasure, her delight. She shared with him what this is going to mean when Daddy finds out that today I'm okay. I can put my dresses on again without sheep here hiding the blood. I can live again in our home without asking the neighbors for all their old pillowcases and sheets to stop this bleeding. Oh, boy! And when he told her that, it replaced the virtue. He himself felt good about what he had done. In the case of David and Saul, the women did a beautiful, wise, enviable thing that I urge you to copy. They brought music, and they brought singing, and they called a name, and they remembered what they had done. They ascribed. They gave credit to them. They said, you did this, you did that, we're going to talk about it, we're going to sing about it, and not only sing, but we're going to physically exert units of energy. We're going to have the force to get in the crevices of your heart and let you know, we thank you, Daddy. We thank you, Uncle David. We thank you, Uncle Ebenezer. We thank you, Uncle Charles, that you defended us. You went to war. We stayed at home. We were women and babies, and you were men, and you went to give your life and lay it on the line. So it was do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Clink, 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 chink, 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 dance, 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 in their pretty clothes to say thank you. It was the replenishing of the virtue. June 29th, I was in Chicago, that great American city. Magnificent citadel in the Midwest. I had a few hours on my hands that I had planned, and I drove through its streets. Chicago has always devastated my emotions, even from the air, but from its south side, I had an experience in it. And I remembered what happened in Chicago. Oh, a while ago. In one of these high rises, there was a fire. 17 stories high was the heart and the fury of the blaze. And the fire captains were there. And they had a hydraulically extended ladder. And they put it up against that building. And fortunately, it reached to the 17th floor. There was a little girl trapped in one of those apartments. Her mother was at work. And this little girl was left alone to care for herself. And a rookie fireman, able, strong, trained, was sent to the captain up that ladder. If you have never climbed heights, that's, I'm waiting on you to find out what that is. He got up about two-thirds of the way. By that time, there was a great crowd of Chicagoans watching. Okay, he froze. And that might not ever have happened to you. And so you might not have any willingness to excuse it in a man. I was running a job one time when a very experienced iron worker froze at only 38 feet. A man in his 50s, a man who walked iron, pulled welding cables, he froze at 38 feet. And it embarrassed him so much when we got him down, we literally had to take him down. It embarrassed him so bad he never would come back to that job again. We finished it without him.
38 feet. It can happen, even to a seasoned producer.
Well, it happened to that young fireman that he froze, and the crowd responded wrong.
What's the matter with you, scaredy cat? I thought you was a fireman.
Boo. And the fire chief got up on the back of his truck, and he took his megaphone.
Ladies and gentlemen, tragedy is in that 17th floor. There's a little girl there. Her mother's at work. Give the young man a high cheer.
And the crowd caught that good sense, and the booing stopped. And there came an applause from all over the young people and the men and the women. And they began to say, go ahead, fella. Go ahead, fella. You can do it. And it broke that phenomenon of height here. And that able-bodied man went on up. And they watched as they held their breath as he reached his arms inside that room. And that little girl with her pigtails grabbed the hold of him. And holding her now with one hand, with less control, he backed himself down 17 floors and brought that child to the streets. It happened in Chicago. The fire captain realized that this man was having not a fuel starvation or an oil starvation in the bearings, but he was having a virtue starvation. Now, if you operate heavy equipment, son, do you ever watch those gauges? And if you ever starve a diesel engine and let it lug, and if you don't notice that something happens and that oil pressure gauge suddenly drops, you are in big trouble. But in our world, we let people be virtually starved. And instead of saying, you're doing a good job, young man, we say, you ought to go back to the farm. We say, your mother would be ashamed of you if she was living. Instead of husbands understanding, God help us to understand the rigors of caring moment by moment for three little preschool children. The husband comes in and says, what do you do all day? I'll tell you what, if most men had to care for three little children, their brains would petrify. And a part of their anatomy would fall off in the middle of the street. And they said, what do you do every day? And instead of restoring that virtue that goes out by the chunks in a young mother, there are just plenty of people just to nitpick her, criticize her, and hurt her further. Dumb, dumb. Only God knows, repeat that, only God knows the extreme virtue that passes out of a pastor on Sunday. Amma Jean Kilgore said somebody came along singing a song, every day will be Sunday, by and by. She says, I hope to God not. When the work world says, thank God it's Friday, we say, whoo, it's Friday already. It's coming. I never have been an enthusiastic blood donor. I've done it. Here they're coming at you with that cotton, that alcohol, and that needle. Lay down there. Where? Right here. When? Now. Gouge that needle. Looks a yard long to me. Stuff that thing up my wrist. Make a fist. Plenty of it. It's come out easy. You can't do that always. You can do it occasionally. But you can't keep giving pints of blood until your body
has the time to replenish that virtue. And I'm telling you that for a pastor and his wife to give out what has to be given out to an unnoticing, unappreciative, uncaring, unresponsive audience is suicide on a daily basis. That ought to not once be named among us that we let people give handsomely and we tip them with bent pennies. I'm letting you smoke that a little while, see if you like it. Ahasuerus couldn't sleep. That's not uncommon for people in leadership. King over 126 provinces and nations. Took his bath. That didn't help. Servants fanned him. Said them fans make too much noise. Let me try this. He kept turning on the bed hinges and just couldn't go to sleep. After a while, he said, I ain't no need to try this. So he got up, he put his robe on, he said to his reader, he said, go get me some books. To read to me. Get the Chronicles of the King. And so the reader started reading, and he got to that place where Mordecai discovered an assassination plot. The king's chamberlains, the servants that worked making up his bed, etc., they had planned to kill him in his sleep, assassinate him, turn the government over to a point. As he read that, the king remembered all that, and all these things went back through his mind. He said, wait a minute. He said, look in the records and see what has been done for that man. And he said, all right, wait just a minute. Let me look under the account here. Mordecai. Oh, here he is. Mordecai. He's got a job down there opening up the gate and all in the hinges. We didn't put him on any kind of military. We ain't done nothing for him. The king comes straight up. He said, I'm not going on an outfit like that, a two-bit penny and a TGNY store. He said, look here. That man put his name on the line to tell on me, to squeal on his fellow servants. You know, it's like going to the district attorney and then to the grand jury to accuse a rapist, knowing that he's a judge, his brother-in-law, they're going to let him off. You're too smart for that. You're not going to go sign your name, identify this guy in a lineup. If he's a judge's brother, he's going to be let off because next week he's going to put his hand on your doorknob. It's jeopardy. And for this man who was a fellow employee of the palace to come and say, I'm going to tell you, these two turkeys plan to get you. They're going to stick you with a knife. And they're going to wait till you get to sleep, and they're going to cut your throat. And this is what I heard him say. I don't know what you're going to do with it, but I love you, and I care about you, and I think you ought to know. And the king gave a proper investigation and found it to be so. Put him to death for attempted treason, attempted assassination. But that's where it stopped. And even in all of our lives, I bet you, stops in our lives, things that we ought to have done to respond to the good folks in our life. The book is blank. Go stand at your mother's grave and ask yourself, did you ever really tell her like you ought to have told her? Mama, I love you. I miss you. Did you? There's some folks never been back to their daddy's grave since they buried. They don't care. Their books were blank. Nothing. Nothing has been done for him. We didn't even give him a pound of rice. We didn't give him a chicken for his kitchen. Nothing. And this man, with the qualities of being able to govern the world, he said, no way, Jose, I'm not going to run an outfit like that.
Not another day is going to go by but what I replenish the virtue in a valuable citizen.
And so, the comedy part of the book of Esther is here comes the chief gobbler of all the turkeys. He came there early to arrange the hanging of this man who had given virtue. That's what he was out in the court for. He came to get the warrant. To hang him till he was dead. Done had the gallows built. Done invited all his rogues to the hanging. So he comes out there particularly well dressed and he comes to work early. And the king said, "Who's that stumbling around out there in the front office?" And he said, "That's Haman." Well, he said, "I need to see somebody with arrangement, organizational bills." He sent him in here. Haman comes in, considering that a stroke of luck. Old king's still sleepy. He says, "Haman," he said, "if there was somebody that you wanted to give the ultimate honor to, you know, do it right." And Haman began to blush. He said, "Oh, dog, my ship has come on in." He said, "What would you do, Haman, if today was the day to fix it? I mean, if today was the day to lay the egg, what would you do?" Well, Haman knew how he had so wished he could ride that Arabian. Oh, he wished he could throw his leg over that stallion and ride him. So he said, "Well, first thing I do, I'll give you a little list of things." He said, "First thing I do," he said, "I would saddle up old Buck with a silver studded saddle and have to put this honorable person on him. And also, I'd say, well, that big diamond studded crown, the envy of the world, didn't wear that for a cap, okay? Put the king's crown on him and dress him in the king's robes, put all the king's jewelry on him, get a squadron of loud mouth fellas to run in front of him and say, 'Here he is! Everybody found him!' And all this junkie listed on that." King said, "That's what I'm going to do." And he said, "I won't ever go to that. I like everything you prescribe." He said, "Run out there right quick and get Mordecai up and bring him in here. And put it on him. Now look out, you're fixing to fall off the rim and miss my point there." The point is not the comedy of it. The point of it was that a king who was a king rectified that situation of someone who had given units but not been replaced. Okay? Galatians 6 and 6 said, "Let him that is taught in the word communicate with him that teacheth." Good services and good teaching and good relationships with a pastor and a teacher ought to be like a checker game. You know, I can just tie you in knots playing checkers and be as dumb as I am. All I got to do is just not move my checker. You'll bite your fingernails, thump your toes, call for another coat, and they'll tell you what you'll do. I don't have to do nothing but just do nothing to mess it up. Because checkers has to be a reciprocal game. And you know, pastors and teachers and evangelists and singers and testifiers and home Bible teachers and other people that are giving generous and glorious portions of their living and their life, their know-how, their energy, their enthusiasm, their beauty, they can give those things in an unresponsive audience and an uncaring, stupid group of people. When I say stupid, I mean that in the medical sense, that you can't respond, you can't hear, you can't see, you don't know what's going on, you ain't there, you're not with it. Can wear a pastor, wear a preacher, wear a pastor's wife, wear a youth leader down until where after a while they're worn to the mud. And then they say, what's with him? When we call him, he was victorious, he was exuberant, he was powerful, he had vision. He's watered down. You bet he's watered down. And you squirted him. if so be you did not appropriately respond to the units of virtue he spent.
Let him that is taught in the Word of God communicate with him that is teaching. I believe when you're in an audience, you ought to play the checkers. One way to play the checkers, that's right. Another way to play the checkers, amen. And if you're dark enough, you can say, right on, brother.
One thing I do hate to do is to be trying to lead somebody in counsel through a very intricate thing. And I check for response. I say, do you understand that? And their eyes kind of dilate and come back and they say, what? They weren't listening. Wasn't thinking. They won't let you make a point because they're not going to respond. I'll tell you, if there's anything in this world that's cruel, it's for a delicate and precious woman to love a man that is a turkey. A dingbat. I've seen that many, many, many times in my lifetime. I've seen precious, valuable, wonderful women in love with stumps. No response. You know, the cartoonist way of showing that is at breakfast he's got a newspaper. I nearly slipped down the red clay back then when I said that. Okay, let's use a little semantics of an English word, responsible. If you have a retarded person in your family, if it's a 36-year-old cousin or a 9-year-old little girl, it doesn't matter, you have to know this phenomenon. That when guests come and you want good relations and good fellowship, at some point or another, if they don't know it, you have to say, he's not responsible. What that means is he don't know what you're talking about. He's in another world. He's got a pickle for a brain. He ain't hear nothing. He don't know what's going on. What is the word we use? Responsible. Able to respond. You know, you just never once in your lifetime want to be irresponsive to the Word of God. My wife is my best friend for these many years. We've been married 33 years, and we were sweethearts and childhood friends before then. I went through a period that we had hundreds of people receiving the baptism of the Holy Ghost and being baptized. It was something that God our Father did for us. And I saw the admiral raise the flag over there, and I'm just the captain of this little cruiser, and I saw him raise the signal flag, and I said, it's time to stop this and teach something in these people to make an apostolic church out of this congregation. And so I got out my double bottom plow, and I held the handles up until the dirt turned up yellow. And it was fur flew and teeth knocked. And I'm a gentle, kind person who would prefer at any time to avoid confrontation. I'd just like you to be smart enough to catch on to what you're supposed to do without my having to tell you in other ways. But I realize that a successful leader has to follow into as many roles as he needs to follow to reach the different kinds of people who are hearing. And so it was my time to be raunchy. You know, you have to do that to pastor church once in a while. You know, you don't have to have a plaque around your neck to go to the supper table. I'm boss here. I'm the daddy. You don't have to do that. About once a year, you just come home from work, and that old dog that's on the doorstep, just kick him, slam over the chain link fence, jerk that screen door off by the hinges, and walk in and say, where's my supper? And then the rest of the year, you're home free. And in order to pass the church one, you have to. So, I found a note that my wife had written me and left in my Bible. It goes, the what's for public goes something like this. Daddy, I'm with you all the way. Be strong. Be clear. Be plain. Because in preaching like this, you'll save both yourselves and me and those that hear you. I don't never worry about whether Bonnie Marie's behind me. She said one time, I said, I didn't see too much support out of you tonight.
Well, she said, if I'd have known that, I'd have been standing on that pew waving my purse. Get it, Daddy. She doesn't want me to spin without it being put back.
I'm going to use the word duty now to show you that what I'm talking about is not just teaching you politeness and manners. I'm talking to you about a judgment day, a duty that you will be measured by on judgment day. In Romans 15 and 26 and 27, Romans 15, 26 and 27, I want to show you that replacing the virtue is a duty. It's not just what good-mannered people do, but it's what every saint, every Christian should do in the light of passing the judgment examination.